Diane on the podcast this week, Living in an Age of Anxiety.
That was the famous W.H. Auden poem, right, from right after World War II. We're living in an age of anxiety, and it manifests in just a tsunami of compulsive behaviors.
I'll talk to science writer Sharon Begley about her new book on how compulsions actually help us cope. But first, Glenn Thrush.
You have a president who's supremely confident in his own management style, which is very idiosyncratic. Does he have the capacity to adjust to the demands of the most demanding job in the world?
He's New York Times White House correspondent.
From New York, it's Saturday night!
You may have heard his name on Saturday Night Live last weekend.
Okay, we'll do a couple questions. Go. Glenn Thrush, New York Times. Boo! Go ahead.
He's closely following the inner workings of this new administration, and some of his recent reporting has revealed surprising details about how the Trump team operates and the impulsivity of the president. He joined me in the studio. Glenn, it's so great to see you again.
Great to be here.
So your piece on the New York Times, co-written with Maggie Haberman, about how the White House is operating. First of all, I know you can't give out sources.
Right.
But somebody in there is giving you material. And what are they telling you?
Well, first I should say that our goal was to just do a story that gave our readers and the American public as candid and as accurate an impression as to how the Trump presidency looked from the inside for the first 2 weeks. We interviewed, I would say, between 40 and 50 administration staffers, campaign staff. The truth of the matter is, and a lot of people have kind of decried leaks in the wake of this story, most of the conversations that we had were not pointed or intended to paint an unflattering portrait. They were just conversations with people who are communicating with the president and his top advisors. And the metaphor that I have been using, and it's not the most elegant one in the world, is Steve Bannon, the president of the United States, decided to go on a carpet bombing campaign of executive orders and taunts to world leaders at a time when they were still learning how to fly the plane. And I think that explains an awful lot of the missteps, the bold actions that they've taken, and some of the corrections that they're going to have to make in the upcoming weeks.
And, of course, Donald Trump did not like your story very much.
Well, we don't know that. We hear that he didn't like it very much. I don't know why he didn't like it. I mean, I don't think we were – I know that sounds crazy, and there are probably people in the White House are going to laugh at that. Most candidates like to manage their image. And when I covered Hillary Clinton for a really long time, and the common line that people would give me on Hillary Clinton is, if you only knew the real Hillary Clinton, what you're seeing in public is not the real person. And there was something to that. I had her on my podcast last year, and we talked for 45 minutes. The truth is, Donald Trump doesn't want you to know the real Donald Trump. He's a man who is concerned about brand. He's concerned about image. So even the most innocuous internal details of how he operates tend to be something he doesn't want to talk about.
And here's what you open with. You say, President Trump loves to set the day's narrative at dawn, but the deeper story of his is at night. What do you mean?
Well, it's interesting. That duality is really striking. I covered the White House under President Obama for a couple of years. And the place was a beehive of activity, some would say overly organized, overly empowered, too many aides, granted. But you could show up there for a briefing, as we were called sometimes to do, at 10 o'clock at night, and there would be a sense that this was really the nerve center of the country. Well, at night at the White House right now, there is a sense of emptiness. There isn't enough staff, even though numerically, I think, the Trump folks say that they've hired sufficient people, but our reporting bore out the fact that there are a ton of senior positions at the White House that haven't been filled because a lot of the folks who are empowered to make those decisions are worried that Trump is going to yell at them if they don't pick the right person. So what you have here is a situation where you have no more than a dozen, I would say six or seven, highly empowered people who are sitting around making all the decisions. there's an image that's really striking. We talk about the day and night duality, and we talk about people wandering around not knowing where the light switches are. That, you know, that's obviously they're figuring that stuff out, right? But here's the deeper question that the story poses. You have a president who's supremely confident in his own management style, which is very idiosyncratic. It came from running a family real estate business, running a presidential campaign that he himself, chaotic presidential campaign, he himself probably didn't think he was going to win. Does he have the capacity to adjust to the demands of the most demanding job in the world? Will he make changes? Will he hire the right people to do this? I think that, more than any of the ideological stuff or any of the celebrity stuff or any of the tweets, is the seminal question that we're facing right now.
I think one of the issues coming up is the nomination of Neil Gorsuch as the Supreme Court Justice, filling in for Antonin Scalia. And we heard this week Neil Gorsuch make comments about President Trump's comments on the judges, right, who are considering whether his ban on Muslims is legal. President Trump says it's not a ban on Muslims, and yet he used the word Muslims in creating the ban.
In the course of tweets, in the course of campaign speeches, we have heard at least three different versions of this coming from Sean Spicer, his press secretary, in the briefing room. I mean, they are really, I think, very much at a disadvantage because of how sloppy their articulation of this stuff is. And then the other thing that he did, obviously, was in a series of tweets to question, what do you call them, a so-called judge who issued the restraining order. And this is something that Neil Gorsuch, in a meeting with the Connecticut senator, Richard Blumenthal, apparently told Blumenthal that he was, I can't remember the exact articulation, he was disconcerted by this. It was disheartening to hear the president talk this way. You know, President Trump is not unfamiliar with the judiciary. His sister, Judge Barry, sits in Pennsylvania District Court, Federal District Court. She's been on the court and a highly respected jurist. To me, the most interesting interaction right now would be, what is his sister saying to him, if anything, about his attack on the judiciary?
But what might his reaction be to Judge Gorsuch's statements? And, I mean, he seems horrified and said, oh, they were taken out of context.
Well, here's what's crazier about this. They had one of the worst weeks, and I've covered a lot of presidencies. They had one of the worst weeks just in terms of the optics that week that Gorsuch was picked for the Supreme Court. But the staging of that particular event, I believe it was Wednesday night, was flawless. The president he has never looked more presidential. He has never spoken more presidentially standing there in the East Room. And Neil Gorsuch has impressed everybody that he's met with, even people who are ideologically opposed to his nomination. Okay. So why would you create a dynamic? Talk about not thinking ahead. Why would you create a dynamic where you're one really good news story, a validating factor? The first major real decision, by the way, that you've made as president. Why would you step on that storyline, and why would you diminish your own standing by creating this dissonance of message?
How do you answer that question?
I think because we have a president who during the campaign had issues with impulse control. He says what pops into his head. Kellyanne Conway, his spokeswoman, who herself has gotten into some trouble lately, right, said a few weeks ago, people laughed at her. She said, you can't listen to what comes out of his mouth. You have to consider what's in his heart. Now, to me, that is actually the most rational possible defense, because it says, listen, don't take everything he says completely
seriously.
Don't
pay attention to what he's saying. Just look for the goodness that he may bring to the table. We haven't seen much of that goodness, have we?
Well, again, I get the biggest act. I think the other thing that people really don't fully comprehend, the casual observer of this, and as we know, it's funny. I was just back in the Times Bureau with a bunch of my colleagues, and we were talking about story ideas. And one of the things that one of my colleagues said to me was, we're looking for results and reactions. And the truth of the matter is nothing has really happened yet. The consequences of the president's actions are yet to be gauged. Ultimately, Diane, the economy and all that stuff is going to be the litmus by which the president is judged. I'd say the Gorsuch nomination, which really was his first concrete and biggest concrete action by far, way more important than the migrant ban, was widely hailed. So why are we talking only about the negative stuff? I'll tell you why. Because this is a guy, the president of the United States, who can't stop talking about negative stuff. He can't put it in the rearview mirror. He has a compulsion to keep bringing up the most negative things. It befuddles me as somebody who covers this because we need an empowered president in this country. It's the way that the system is set up. And from my point of view, unless he is so sui generis and is playing by his own set of rules, which is possible, he's squandering political capital that he's going to need in these big legislative battles.
Clinton, you got a big call out from Melissa McCarthy on Saturday Night Live when she performed as White House Press Secretary Sean Spicer.
You had to have known that I would ask that question.
Okay, sit down, Glenn. Who here, just by show of hands, who here hates Glenn? Right? Everybody? 1, 2, 3, infinity? Now, see, let the record show that everyone raised their hands because everybody hates Glenn. So print that. That's your story. Next question. Go.
You must have been thrilled to see Glenn Thrush called on.
Well, I'm always thrilled to get called on in the briefing room because it's not a foregone conclusion. I would say it is very much a mixed blessing. My kids loved it. For that day in school, their principal visited them in their world studies class and pulled them out. For me, it's a little bit of a mixed blessing. And I'm not being it is obviously. And by the way, this is a great skit and people are going to remember it for a really long time. So my name is all over it, which, by the way, is cool. And I did nothing to deserve it. So anytime I can get a benefit where I do no work, it's great. But the problem here is, and I am actually serious about this, I'm not the story. The reason I was in that clip is because Sean Spicer, a couple of days earlier, had impugned the reporting of one of my colleagues who had reported that there was reported completely accurately that there was terrible coordination between the Department of Homeland Security and the White House on the immigration ban, right? And Sean Spicer stood at the podium and called our story false, and I wasn't going to take it. And I shouted out of turn, that is inaccurate, Sean. You can't say that. We stand behind that story because he's impugning the integrity of my colleagues. So while it's really nice that he did that, it's very important, particularly in an environment where Steve Bannon, the president's chief advisor, has called the press the opposition. For us, we are not the opposition, and we are not performers. We're there to do a job, and we're there to establish a wall of fact.
And speaking of Stephen Bannon, apparently he remains the president's dominant advisor, despite President Trump's anger that he says he was not fully briefed on the details of the executive order about banning certain persons from immigrating to this country.
Right, and also the bigger revelation, I think, is that he was not briefed about Bannon's own elevation to the Principals Committee of the National Security Council.
So who did that elevation?
Well, what's interesting, we don't quite know, but I think we can have... I think the educated reader could draw conclusions on this. Now,
can he really elevate himself?
The president of the United States signs an executive order, particularly reordering the executive department of the federal government. That is within his powers.
You're saying he didn't know what he was signing when he elevated Steve Bannon?
Here's what we know. I think there was a lot of people jumped to a lot of conclusions that the president didn't read the executive order. Our reporting did not show that. I think the president of the United States read the executive order, but here's the thing. He was not given the proper historical or operational context. It's not just a matter of reading the words off the page. The reason why you staff a White House with professionals who know what they're doing is they tell you what the potential backlash is going to be and what the implications of your actions are. And the implications of that action was to elevate a political aide with some naval experience. I should say Bannon served in the Navy, was an adjutant to an admiral. But to elevate a man who is essentially a political advisor to a job that to a status on the permanent committee that had not been afforded an advisor, while at the same time not demoting, but assigning to a somewhat subordinate position the head of the Joint Chiefs of Staff and the head of the director of National Intelligence. And that was a significant action that had a significant reaction. And I think our reporting shows that while Mr. Trump may have been shown the text of the executive order and had an explanation, he was not sufficiently briefed on that aspect of it and was upset. And the other thing that we report, and I think this is quite a positive, is that Reince Priebus, the chief of staff to the president, as a result of this confusion on the executive orders, has instituted a new 10-point protocol to ensure that this kind of thing doesn't happen again.
Is Steve Bannon going to listen to Reince Priebus?
That's why we put out a newspaper every day. I guess we're going to find that out, right? We pay the printing plant.
Yeah, you bet. Yeah. And you talk about four chairs in front of his
striking
desk. What does that mean? What does that indicate?
Well, I can do the side by side with the way President Obama organized things. First of all, President Obama didn't do an awful lot of. I don't think people really understand this. The geography of the West Wing is very interesting. It's a really small building, and it's funny. We have a real estate developer. The real estate decisions you make internally in the West Wing are really important, right? And President Obama did most of his office, most of his work in this small cloistered study off of the West Wing. So there were ceremonial meetings, and he did some business in the West Wing, in the Oval Office, rather. President Trump does a lot of business at his desk. When you walk into his office, and you can see this, he's got piles of paper on his desk. The other place he does a lot of his work is in the dining room, which is a couple of doors down because it has a big flat screen TV. And we also reported that he increased the size of the television so that when he eats his lunch, he can scream at CNN, presumably, right? But the arrangement of these four chairs, which you can see in some of the pictures in the Oval Office, essentially indicate and replicate the way that he did his work at Trump Tower. He wants his aides, typically Sean Spicer, Reince Priebus, Bannon, and that fourth chair, Hope Hicks, a longtime aide of his, and some other people, General Flynn, who's his national security advisor, sits in that. But he is sitting right up in people's faces and interacting with them. I think that, to me, that was one of the more encouraging details that we determined. The problem is, and this is, again, from our exhaustive reporting on this, is there probably are too few people and too few chairs.
Well, finally, the whole issue of the press and comedy, the two things together, really, really getting under President Trump's skin. Is it that he is simply a very sensitive man? Is it that he has no self-control as he sees things and has to respond? What's going on here?
My answer to those questions is yes. I think, you know, what we're not fully reckoning here is Donald Trump's most recent job was entertainment. And so I think we are dealing with and I view this reality TV and The Apprentice, you know, that's not real business he was doing. You know, he has a real business career, branding and some real estate, which he did earlier in his career. But his last job that he held before he ran for public office was as an entertainer. That's why Saturday Night Live really registers with him. He has been incredibly hard on Alec Baldwin, and I'm told that he didn't like the Spicer characterization on Saturday Night Live. This is a guy who views things from an entertainment perspective. And I'll leave you with one observation that Chuck Todd made to me, Chuck Todd of NBC made to me during my podcast when I had it at Politico. It was the last podcast I did. I said, Chuck, what was it like to have Trump on your show? And he said, he did something that was really unusual. After he had concluded it, he sat in the studio with me and he said, can we do playback? And they played the tape. And
The whole tape.
So, you know, 10, 15 minute interview. And they sat there. And Trump said, the first time Trump did it, Chuck was shocked. Trump said, can the control room turn off the sound? And so Chuck Todd and Trump sat and watched the performance just visually with no sound. I've subsequently discovered that that is an old Roger Ailes trick, the former head of Fox, who is was Donald Trump's friend and was an advisor during the campaign, informal advisor during the campaign, that the visuals, and this is the ethos that Ailes had, and it was passed down to Trump, the visuals are more important to him than the words. That's a real thing, and that's been confirmed by aide after aide after aide.
Wow. Thank you so much for coming in.
Really great to see you.
Great to see you, too. Come back again.
Anytime.
All right. Okay, we'll take a quick break. We'll be back.
DCS Daily.
DCS Daily.
DCS Daily.
It's news,
culture, and curiosities.
From the District, Tacoma Park,
Alexandria,
Friendship Heights,
Hyattsville,
Falls Church,
Northeast Washington, D.C., in your inbox every weekday afternoon.
DCS Daily.
Sign up at dcs.com/newsletter.
dcs.com/newsletter.
And we're back. If it feels like we're all a little more anxious these days, science writer Sharon Begley says it's true. She's got a new book out called Just Can't Stop, An Investigation of Compulsions. Sharon Begley joined me from Boston. Hi, Sharon. It's good to hear your voice again.
It's great to be back with you, Diane. Thank you.
Tell me about compulsions. Are we into a new age of compulsion?
Well, that was the guiding question before me as I started out on this book. You know, you look around you and you see people who seem to be acting, behaving compulsively. And by that I mean that they, and I guess I should say we, are engaging in repetitive behaviors over and over and over again.
Such as?
Checking our phones, texting, but also shopping. In extreme forms, for somebody with OCD, washing their hands dozens, scores of times a day, exercising. The manifestations of compulsions are just all around us. And, you know, in answer to your question, the data are not great on whether they are increasing, but certainly the feeling behind them, the feeling that underlies them, namely anxiety, does seem to be increasing.
You know, well, I was so interested in reading that you believe that writing is even something of a compulsion. You go back to the era of John Milton, Ernest Hemingway, who could not stop writing.
Well, that was one of the things I really, really wanted to include in the book, because when people talk about compulsive behaviors, there's almost an assumption or an insinuation that they are a problem, that they might even be evidence of a mental disorder. But, you know, if you look throughout history, if you look at your acquaintances, whether it's compulsive working or compulsive creation by an artist, clearly there are reasons to be grateful that compulsions exist. So as in your examples a second ago of Hemingway and Milton, they both described this sort of lava inside themselves. And if they did not write, it just felt absolutely awful. So in the case of Milton, every morning he would come down and he would speak the words that had arrived in his head overnight, and it became Paradise Lost. And in the case of Hemingway, he described how if he did not write, he felt absolutely awful. It was just this burning thing inside himself that he had to get out.
But it seems to me there you're talking about a compulsion that comes from within. Now, as you look at new technology, smartphones, video games, that sort of thing, then aren't you talking about new technology and how that may be indeed creating from the outside new compulsions?
Well, they are. I would phrase it slightly differently, namely that these digital lures are tapping into something very basic in the brain. So it's not that they are creating compulsions from nothing. Instead, they are sort of strapping themselves to something that's quite healthy in the brain and something that has shown up in a lot of ways throughout history. So that's very general. Let me give you an example. So one of the things that people deeply, deeply need is to feel connected, right? We don't want to feel isolated. We don't want to feel alone. We want to feel part of a larger community. And these days, more and more, that's being done online. So you feel compelled to check to see if a new text has come in. You feel compelled to go on social media and see what your friends and acquaintances are doing. And actually, Diane, that was one of the reasons that I started the book. I looked around at the newsroom where I was working at the time, and nobody can go to the ladies' room, right, without their phone in their hands. And one of the things really that struck me was that people were not enjoying it all that much. It was really born of anxiety rather than, you know, enjoyment, entertainment, whatever. So that's just sort of got me going to look at what the negative emotion, anxiety, is in driving so many of our compulsions, including the digital ones.
So indeed, here's your sentence. We cling to compulsions as a lifeline, for it's only by engaging in compulsions that we can drain enough of our anxiety to function. So you're saying we're checking on our email to relieve our anxiety, which indeed may create a compulsion that's never ending.
Because exactly as you're saying, the compulsion works. It drains anxiety that would otherwise be unbearable. So let me give you an example just from, you know, this morning. So I was waiting to come on and chat with you, Diane, and I'm expecting news to break in a subject that I cover. You can believe that my eyes were glued to my phone screen every single minute. It wasn't enjoyable, but it's driven by anxiety, and that's how we all behave these days.
You know, I wonder whether people's brains look different when they have compulsions from those who do not.
So one of the challenges in doing this book was that the science here is still, what shall we say, ongoing. There are no or very few definitive answers. However, the one form of compulsion that has been well studied, because it clearly is a mental disorder, is obsessive compulsive disorder, OCD. And in that case, the brain imaging absolutely has shown that there is overactivity in the circuit that tells you something is wrong, something is amiss. And that something can be, I think I left the door unlocked, or, oh dear, I believe that my hands are covered with germs. So in people who are suffering from OCD, that region of the brain absolutely is on overdrive. And when they give into the compulsion, when they check the front door, when they check to see if the stove is on, when they wash their hands for the umpteenth time that day, then that activity does dissipate. So again, the compulsion has worked. It has helped to drain the anxiety that they feel.
On the other hand, many of us may have so-called mild compulsions, just checking our iPhone. But when does that move into mental pathology?
So that was one of the most, to me, satisfying parts of the research and reporting I did for this, talking to people who have, exactly as you say, mild compulsions. So the short answer to your question, when does that tip into pathology, is, according to the American Psychiatric Association, only when a behavior causes distress and impairment does it count as a mental disorder. Now, you know, psychiatry is still struggling to be a science. It's certainly not an exact science. There's no blood pressure cuff. There's no blood test for a psychiatric illness. It's quite subjective. It depends on what the person, him or herself, reports as symptoms. So, you know, you can argue with what mainstream psychiatry has decreed, but what it says is only when there is distress and impairment is there a diagnosable, treatable mental disorder. And as we've been saying, in many forms of compulsion, it's the opposite of distress. The compulsion is decreasing your sense of distress. It is decreasing your anxiety. So it doesn't qualify. But let me just give you one quick example, Diane. So I was speaking to one woman who is like many people that I bet we all know. She is just very compulsive about how she keeps her house. Every teacup has to be in exactly the right place. Her pantry is arranged according to rules that only she can understand. So in talking to her, I almost put her on a couch and asked her, you know, just where does she think that comes from? And she thought back to her childhood in Europe, where her parents were very, very unpredictable. She didn't know if they were going to be kind one day and cruel the next. Things just felt very out of control. But she learned that by imposing order on a teeny bit of her environment, she got a sense that, in fact, the world was not spiraling out of control, or at least, you know, her little bit of it was not.
Sharon, I have to confess to you, I am one of those people. Every cabinet has to be totally organized. My husband, my late husband, was even worse. The spices in the cabinets were all in alphabetical order. And if someone cleaned that cabinet and the spices were out of order, he'd go nuts and have to alphabetize them as he went back for a spice.
I think that's something we all feel in these crazy times. I can't control what's happening, you know, in Washington, to pick an appropriate example these days. But I can do something about my own little world, and I'm going to do it compulsively.
You know, it's so fascinating that you talked about Washington, because what's happening here with the election of Donald Trump seems to be creating lots of anxiety in people, not only here in Washington, but around the world. As the president talks about what he said to the Australian prime minister, as we talk about his tweeting, and one begins to wonder whether that tweeting is somewhat compulsive and setting us on edge as well.
Absolutely. And needless to say, I, of course, finished the book before Election Day. I certainly finished the book before January 20th, Inauguration Day. But the kind of anxiety that is just so obvious in, you know, friends and acquaintances and what we read in the news exactly plays into what the researchers had described to me. And that's also why, you know, in retrospect, and I consider myself lucky, that I included a chapter on good compulsions, or I called it compelled to do good. Because in the kind of political atmosphere that we're all living through, you know, if you're just sitting at home and you're wondering, uh-oh, is that conversation with the president of Taiwan going to cause such severe problems with China that we will start shooting at one another, or worse? Is that blow up on the phone with the prime minister of Australia going to lead to who knows what? And many people just can't stand to sit there and do nothing. So I would argue it has pushed them out of their seat. It got them out onto the streets during the Women's March a couple of Saturdays ago. It's continuing to trigger activism. So in that sense, I would again say that this sense of anxiety can be a force for good. And if you are compelled to do something for that reason, you know, go with it.
What about medications for truly compulsive people who, as you might say, are constantly washing their hands? You talk about Parkinson's patients. Talk about the kinds of medications that might be available to those who believe they are nearing the edge or simply almost over the edge.
Yes. So OCD, again, is the sort of paradigmatic example of a compulsive disorder. And because it's fairly common and widely recognized, drug companies have indeed tried to come up with compounds that can help these people, but they have not done a great job. You can be prescribed standard antidepressants called SSRIs. Those are in the Prozac, Zoloft class. And for some people, they help. But as we know, they also have significant side effects. So there's also talk therapy for OCD, two kinds. One is give people an exposure to the thing that they are really, really afraid of. So if you are if your OCD shows up as the need to wash your hands all the time because you believe that you are covered in germs, the therapy has people touch things that might be or actually are covered in germs and see if they can stand it, see if they can sort of keep themselves from running to the sink for even a few seconds and then for a minute. But it's a kind of cruel therapy, I have to say, because people are suffering when they're told to touch a dirty rug or to, and this is a real example, to touch toilets in public restrooms. So the treatments for these are not great. There are a couple of others. There's a cognitive behavioral therapy for OCD. But the real problem, Diane, is in all of these compulsions that where the science is not great and which have not been recognized as disorders, and therefore you can't get insurance coverage for them. And therapists are often just at sea. They have no idea how to help people who come to them. And I'll just finally add, that's also true of OCD. I talked to a number of people, patients with OCD, again, the most widely recognized compulsive disorder. And even they have to go to 3, 4, 5 therapists before they find one who is skilled in treating it. So it's really a very sad situation.
Sharon, I realize you are not a mental health professional. However, having written this book, having watched after the election, and indeed even through the election, I wonder if you believe we have entered a new age of anxiety in terms of our whole political system. Do you think that is creating more anxiety for all of us?
Diane, I'm going to go to the data. And that shows that among U.S. adults, something like 18% describe something that is very close to, if not exactly, an anxiety disorder, compared to 7% who report depression. And I think for a long time, the assumption was that depression was much more common, even among college students. So in the most recent mental health survey of college students, 23% reported anxiety affecting their academic performance, compared to 15% for depression. So anxiety has overtaken depression, even among college students. And, a lot of this crystallized for me when I found a quote from a medical historian. He died a few years ago. His name was Roy Porter. And he said, quote, "Every age gets the lunatics it deserves." So put aside the problematic word lunatic. But his argument was whatever the sort of atmosphere of the age, that just triggers certain anxieties or certain mental health situations, shall we say. And so I would absolutely say that we are living in an age of anxiety. In fact, that was the famous W.H. Auden poem, right, from right after World War II. We're living in an age of anxiety, and it manifests in a tsunami of compulsive behaviors.
Sharon Begley, thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Diane.
And finally, a new segment we're calling From the Archives. This week, concert violinist Joshua Bell. He's here in Washington, D.C., doing a number of performances, including a family show inspired by the time he played incognito in the D.C. Metro and was not recognized. Here's a clip from our 2009 interview describing the experiment.
Well, it's almost 3 years ago now, and it's still following me around. When I did it, I didn't expect anyone to be talking about it past the maybe a week after the publication.
But it was unusual.
Gene Weingarten, the journalist who had ended up winning the Pulitzer Prize for it, he approached me and said, I need someone to do this for me. I need an artist who generally gets audiences to pay money to hear. I want an artist like that to play in the subway and in the metro station, and I want to see what happens. I want to follow the audience. He followed the audience afterwards and interviewed them, asked them why they stopped or didn't stop, and et cetera. And I played along. I thought it would be fun to do something like that. It was a bit of an adventure for me to take out my violin case in the middle of rush hour in this train station. And surprisingly, I mean, it got a lot of attention. It got spread in every country I've been to since then. It seems to be the first question people ask.
But tell me what the reactions were from the people.
Different people got different things. I mean, I think the general sentiment that many people came away with was that, you know, we don't pay attention to what's around us. We live with blinders on, and we don't always see the beauty of what's. I hate to say that because that makes me the beauty in that story. So, but for me, I got the fact that really, something I always knew though is that classical music or any kind of music, serious music, really needs special attention and the right atmosphere and the full concentration of the listener. It's a two-way street there, and you can't throw it at people while they're
do you
running
think they recognized you?
Recognized me?
Yes.
That was not the purpose of the experiment. It had nothing to do with recognizing
did
me.
Did anybody want to leave you money?
Yeah, they left me some money. I made $40-some in 40 minutes. It's not that bad.
And you can listen to that entire show with Joshua Bell, as well as my other interviews with him at drshow.org. That's our show for the week. As always, we want to hear from you, so find us at Facebook or Twitter. Send us an email at drshow@wamu.org or leave us a voice memo at 202-854-8851. Our theme music was composed by Cliff Harden and comes to us courtesy of the Capitol Soundtrack Project here at WAMU. The show was produced by Sandra Baker and Rebecca Kaufman. Thanks, and talk to you next week.